Well, everything is good, but you actually have to make a specific thing. That's second best. The best thing is to say 9 to 10.
I'm not so trusting to them.
Would you like to come in? Hi, everybody. Hope you had a nice Bein Hazmanim, although it was probably relatively short. And again, we're still a little behind, but I just wanted to finish the Aseret HaDibros. We didn't finish all 10 of them. We were looking at the fourth commandment. Again, we'll connect it to the Mishkan. And that is, remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. And remember that it comes in two versions. The version in the book of Shmos is Zachor, remember the Shabbos. And in V'yaschanan, it is observe the Shabbos. And they are very different. Zachor is the positive commandment of remembering Shabbos by Kiddush and Havdalah and making meals, etc. And Shamar is keeping the Shabbos by not violating the 39 categories of Malacha. Now you'll recall that this Parsha, the coming week's Parsha, is about the building of a Mishkan. But you will recall that the very definition of what is a prohibited malacha on Shabbos are the activities that are involved in construction of the Mishkan. In other words, that's the definition, whether it's building, writing. The Gemara identifies how each of the 39 malachos are connected to the building of the Mishkan. In a sense, therefore, the definition of malacha, of prohibited work, does not mean physical labor. This is a very common, you know, misconception. I'm sure people have said to you, or maybe you thought yourself, well, you know, listen, we say you're not supposed to turn on an electric light because that's making fire. And the Torah says you cannot make fire on Shabbos. So people will say, well, that's crazy. In the olden days, you had to rub two stones together. It was very laborious. It was very hard. How can you tell me that flicking an electric switch is making a fire, right? People always ask this question. Or I remember, I have a memory in my own mind that I remember when I was 12 or 13, so I was going to a classmate's bar mitzvah. And the bar mitzvah was not in a very religious shul, and I had to walk like 3 or 4 miles. And it was the summer, it was hot, and there was no Erev, you couldn't carry any water or anything. So I'm walking, you know, 3 or 4 miles in the summer, and one of my secular teachers, not a Rebbe, was actually driving to the bar mitzvah, and she stopped to offer me a ride. And I said, well, can't really go in a car on Shabbos because that's doing work. So you think about the absurdity of it, you know. So Shabbos, you're supposed to rest, so you walk 5 miles in the sun. But I can't go into the car because that's prohibited labor on Shabbos. Kind of doesn't make sense. But the reason why that's an incorrect analysis is that's assuming that the definition of what you can't do on Shabbos is physical exertion. And then you can ask a logical question. It's a lot easier to drive a car than it is to walk in the heat. But that's not what malacha means. See, these are two different words. The word for physical labor is called avoda, like an evet, a slave. The Torah does not say, do not do avoda on Shabbos. The Torah says, do not do melacha on Shabbos. Melacha, again, Rav Hirsch explains this very beautifully, melacha does not refer to physical exertion. Melacha refers to the exercise of your creativity over the raw materials of nature. A malacha is the act of your mastery, whether it's planting, harvesting, writing, using fire. The problem is not the physical strength. The problem is the exercise of your domination. That since Shabbos commemorates the fact that God created the world in 6 days, and God is the source of all creation, so the way I acknowledge that is by ceasing my creative mastery over technology. So in effect, you could say that if anything, my ability to generate heat and light by turning on a switch is even more of a mastery than the old-fashioned way of making a fire. So the issue is not how much physical effort you're doing, but how much mastery and control you are exercising over the raw materials of nature. That's the definition of a malacha. That is why, according to Doraisa at least, Doraisa, purely destructive actions that do not make anything constructive are actually not forbidden on Shabbos. For example, you are allowed to, again, Doraisa, Drabbanan, you can't, you are allowed to destroy if you're not going to rebuild. For example, the prohibition of destroying a building is only if you're planning on erecting a replacement on the site, so then it becomes a constructive act. If it's purely destructive, it is not a malacha. Now again, midrabanan, it is prohibited. But that's why if you go through the list of the 39 malachas, you will see tearing is prohibited only if it's done with the intention of sowing. Erasing is prohibited only if it's done with the intention of writing something else. This is Doraisa, because it has to be constructive no matter how hard the labor. Now, the only thing you might ask is carrying when there's no Erev. What technology am I exercising? But the answer once again is even the idea of moving something from one type of location to another is a certain mastery, control. Shabbos is about giving up control, recognizing that you're not in control, recognizing that Hashem is the creator of heaven and earth. The only type of creation you can do on Shabbos is, of course, the creation of Torah, right? And the creation of human life. A husband and wife can be intimate on Shabbos. It's even considered to be a proper mitzvah, even though that's the most godly thing of all, creating life. But God did permit you to be godly on that particular day. Right? That's the idea of malacha. In many ways, let me point out that Shabbos represents an opposite but complementary teaching to circumcision. And let me explain why that's so. And you'll notice that it's impossible for a child to ever have a bris unless they've experienced at least part of a Shabbos. In other words, that's why a bris is on the eighth day, because there will always be a Shabbos in between, even if the baby is born on Shabbos. So the bris will be on Shabbos. So in a sense, you have parts of two Shabboses bridging them. Let's look for a moment. I'm going to go backtrack a little bit. Let's look for a moment at the significance of circumcision, right? Bris Milah, very, very important mitzvah, obviously. Now, there is in the United States and in other countries as well a bit of an anti-circumcision movement. Now, people are coming and saying, why are you mutilating, you know, people and the like? Sometimes they even use religious arguments. They basically say, of course it's kind of crazy to use a religious argument when God commanded circumcision, but they make the argument, if God made you a certain way, it is arrogant of you to try to change or improve on what God has given you. Right? That's actually a religious argument against circumcision. In truth, of course, if you remember, there was a case in Germany. I think it may have gotten overruled or changed, but a German court, now this did not involve Jews, but it would be the same principle. A German court basically ruled that Muslim parents were not permitted to have their child circumcised because it was a surgical procedure, not for the medical benefit of a child, and therefore they would have to wait until the child became an adult, which is 18 there, and would be able to consent. Now somebody ought to tell the judge it's going to hurt a lot more at 18 than it does at a younger age.
I thought they do it at 13. Do they not do it at 13?
Yeah, they do it at 13, but so it still hurts. But the court said they can't do it until 18, secularly, because a child, you know, until you're 18, you're not below the age of consent. Now it's very, very fascinating how solicitous the German courts were of the pain that children suffer. They didn't really care that much in the 1930s and early 40s, but I guess they did a lot of tshuva. It reminds me a little bit of. I once, I'm being sarcastic, but I once I was in Poland once. I once took a trip with the seminary to Poland, and we went to Auschwitz concentration camp. And this is really kind of a story. I mean, it would be funny if it wouldn't resonate as tragic. And Auschwitz is the concentration camp is there, so you see what it was. You see the crematoria. You see where people were burned, were murdered, were tortured. But it is a museum as well, so you pay admission. You have to pay admission to visit the concentration camp. I mean, you pay, it's admission, or whatever. So there was a fellow, an old man, who came in, and he didn't pay admission. So with German efficiency, the people who are manning the museum call out to him and say, "Hey, mister, you got to pay." So he showed his numbers, his concentration camp numbers. And he said, I really shouldn't smile at this, but it was such a witty answer, but it brought back, he says, "Hey, that's funny. Last time I was here, they took me in for free." I mean, he was in the concentration camp. Says, "So I'm entitled to go in for free now." So, okay. But be it as it may, people make this religious argument, going back to circumcision, and they say, "You're mutilating God's creation. What are you doing?" So the emesis, this is not a new question. This was a question that a Roman matron asked Rabbi Akiva. It's a medrash. If God wanted Jewish children to be circumcised, why did he create them uncircumcised? This was a question. And Rabbi Akiva gave an answer. Rabbi Akiva gave an example. You know, we eat bread. Why didn't Hashem make bread growing from the ground? Why does Hashem make it that we have to plant, etc.? And Rabbi Akiva said the basic lesson is HaKadosh Baruch Hu truncated the creative process. Meaning, he created seeds, but he didn't automatically create the seeds, turn into plants, turn into flour, turn into bread. He left it with seeds, and then we have to plant, we have to harvest, we have to thresh, we have to make it flour, we have to make it dough, we have to bake it as bread. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu deliberately left the world in a state of physical incompletion so that we become his partners in bringing it to fruition in a very literal way. That is what it means to say man is in the image of God. That has many, many meanings. Free will, etc., intelligence. But part of it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be his partners in being mashlim, the Bria. And that is why we have to make our bread. The bread does not come out of the ground. And Rabbi Akiva says, the same thing is true in Ruchnis. Hashem did not create, at least the male of the species, to be in a state of perfection. We were created pagum, defective. And we must take the initiative to perfect ourselves by bris milah. If you think more deeply about this, this is the whole idea of the oral law. Because, think about this, people make a mistake about Torah Shebal Peh. I hear people say all the time, and again, I mean, it's a well-meaning mistake, so it's maybe it's not the worst mistake a person could make, but it is a mistake. People talk about every word of the Mishnah was given by Hashem to Moshe, and it was just handed down. Every word of the Gemara, because we say it's the oral law, was handed down to Moshe. But, you know, that really is so ridiculous, because you know, the Mishnah says, Rabbi Akiva says this, Beis Hillel says this, Beis Shammai says this, Abaye asks Akasha, Rava gives an answer. Now, these were people who lived in certain times. They lived 1,000 years after the Torah was given. Now, if you're going to say all of these books are literally handed down from Moshe, then you get to the scenario where Beis Hillel is reading a script where he was given an old document that says, actually it wasn't a document, it was oral, right? It was oral. That there was an oral tradition that you, Hillel, should say these words on a certain day. That's not the way it worked. Obviously, when Hillel said certain words, he said words because he was learning Torah, and he said these words. He was not told ahead of time, what the words he's supposed to say is. So obviously the Mishnah and the Gemara are records of debates and discussions that occurred over time. The same way, you know, you are learning. No one told you ahead of time what you're going to ask in your Gemara share. You just asked it. Same thing. Now, of course, they were much infinitely greater than us. I don't mean the quality of our discussion is the quality of their discussion. Obviously not. But it is, you know, analytically the same process. So what do we mean when we say the oral law was given to Moshe at Sinai? We don't mean the text of the Mishnah. We don't mean the words of the Mishnah. We don't mean the words of the Gemara. That was a product of time. But we mean that the basic fundamental principles out of which these arguments were based were given to Moshe, but then Hashem left it to the sages of every generation to take those principles and grapple with them and apply them to the new questions and problems. So, and this process even goes on today. So, when we say, for example, is electricity fire? Or we say, you know, our microwaves are allowed to be used on Shabbos. The question is not, what did Hashem tell Moshe? Hashem told Moshe, fire. The Chachamim have to decide what is called fire. And that's why there can be arguments in the Gemara. And the arguments can be opposites. One can say something is totally permitted. And one can say something is totally prohibited. And they're both considered right. And people ask the question, how can there be an argument? What did Hashem tell Moshe? The answer, Hashem told Moshe, let the Chachamim decide. That's what Hashem told Moshe. Hashem told Moshe, there is an issue here. I'm telling you fire. Fire has certain characteristics. It generates heat and light. How this will apply to new situations is to be left to the sages. And whatever they come up with is fine with me. Provided, these are big questions, they are qualified sages, that's a biggie, and provided they use the klalim, the general concepts that were given to Moshe B'Sinai, and provided they use the methodology of halacha. Again, these are all very big questions, but the point I'm making is that Torah Shebal Peh is not just a mechanical transmission process. It involves Klal Yisrael in the creating of what the halacha is. Now one might say, that's very messy. Why didn't Hashem just give us the answer that we would hand down? Give us the answer. Then there wouldn't be machlokas. There wouldn't be disagreement. You wouldn't even need a Gemara. You would just have answers to everything. You wouldn't have to prove things. The whole concept of having to bring proofs is based on the idea that I don't know the answer, I got to try to figure it out. That's why people are very frustrated when they start learning Gemara sometimes, because, you know, why don't I just get the answer to things? The answer is, Hashem didn't want to give us the Torah on a silver platter. Hashem basically said, we are partners, we work together. Hashem says, I give you the raw material, and you bake the bread. You make the cake. Now, that's Hashem's love. Hashem basically says, you're not just passively giving Torah. You are part of the process of creating Torah. Now, I know, you could say, oh, that sounds like reform. Well, yeah, it may sound like reform, but it's not reform, because we're talking about people who, number one, believe that Hashem gave basic principles to Moshe at Sinai, as opposed to, God forbid, saying everything is made up. And people who are chachamim and people who have mastered all of the precedents, right? So, yeah, it may sound externally. But the point to remember is that Torah Shebal Peh does involve dynamism, creativity. So when people say, oh, every word of the Gemara, I mean, okay, I don't want to say it's stupid, but it's foolish, because obviously what goes on in a Beis HaMedrash is not somebody scratching their head and saying, what did it say on page 581 of that transcript we got from Moshe? It doesn't work that way. You're using your head. And the same way you use your head, Abaye used his head, and Rava used his head, and Beis Hillel used his head. But that's what Hashem wanted. Now, do you see how this is, I'm getting far afield, do you see how this is connected to Bris Milah? Because Bris Milah is the same idea. Hashem said, I'm not going to make you perfect. I'm going to make you 95% of the way. But you have to then take that step and be my partner in creating Kedusha in the world. Bris Milah is human responsibility to be Mashlim Hashem's Bria. Torah Shebaal Peh is the human responsibility to take the principles of Torah and apply them into the world. And it becomes the will of God. It becomes divine, not because the conclusions were divine, but it's the divine will that the conclusions of the Chachamim become the Torah. So then it becomes divine, but not in the sense that God gave it ahead of time, but in the sense that it's the Ratzon Hashem that the Torah be determined by these methodologies. That is what Bris Milah is. So Bris Milah tells us the very, very important dynamic and creative role that Chachamim have in being, and that's the all of Klal Yisrael has in bringing holiness into the world. Even the determination of time is that way. Let's consider the Jewish calendar. The Jewish calendar is based on Rosh Chodesh. We sanctify the new moon. Now, you might think that that's an astronomical phenomenon, that when the new moon appears, right, the moon towards the end of the month, the moon disappears, and then when you get a sliver, it's a new moon. But you know, that's not really the case. Rosh Chodesh is not defined by the appearance of the moon in and of itself. Rosh Chodesh is defined by the Sanhedrin proclaiming that day to be Rosh Chodesh. And even if they proclaim the wrong day because they were misled by witnesses, the holidays, like Pesach, which is the 15th of the month, is not from the 15th of the true Rosh Chodesh, but it's the 15th of the wrong day that they proclaim. Even today, you might say. So how do I have Rosh Chodesh today if there's no Sanhedrin? The Rambam explains, the last Sanhedrins computed all the Rosh Chodesh in advance, and they sanctified them in advance. If there wouldn't be a sanctification of the Sanhedrin, there would be no Yomim Tovim. Now, that means what? Hashem vests the very definition of time in Am Yisrael. Right? So, this is very, very significant. So, the point I'll get to you in a second. The point I want you to see is that Shabbos is kind of the opposite message. Bris Milah is our power, our contribution, our initiative, our responsibility. It gives us godly functions in the world. But there's a problem with that. If all you have is the message of Bris Milah, that could lead to arrogance. That could lead to gaiva. I'm like God. I make the halacha. I make the time. So Shabbos is kind of the opposite message, where you recognize, by refraining from your creativity and your mastery, that God is the ultimate source of creation. And that is why you can't have a bris till you have a Shabbos. Because first and foremost, a person has to know everything comes from God. Once you know everything comes from God, you then have the responsibility not to be passive. See, Judaism is not passive. One might say, oh, if everything comes from God, then I'll let God take care of things. Even in matters of social justice. If there's sickness, I'm not going to go to a doctor. God will take. So these are the two ideas. That Shabbos reminds me everything comes from God, but Bris Milah reminds me that I have a responsibility to bring Hashem's blessings into the world. You need both ideas. Yeah.
So you're saying that on Mount Sinai, God just gave Moshe like a bare set of principles with nothing?
Well, but it could be very, very vast. I'm not suggesting this was a short set of principles. It took 40 days, 40 days and 40 nights. There are many, 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 many principles, but God did not necessarily give him how those principles will be applied to every conceivable situation.
when we see words like white field and things like that in the Mishnah, God may have never spoke about a white field or trees.
That's correct. Absolutely correct. Absolutely. I know a lot of people describe it differently, but if you're asking what I believe is correct, based on the Rambam and others, absolutely. God didn't necessarily talk about white fields. You know, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. It's hard for us to know exactly. See, that itself is very complicated. And the reason is because some things in the Mishnah are drabanans, which clearly came later. Some are interpretations of Doraisas, right? So the problem is we don't have the exact transcript of what Hashem told Moshe. It is true that all of the principles in all of the Mishnah's cases, if they're not drabanans, were given by God to Moshe. But the numerous applications, right? What is the Mishnah? The Mishnah is numerous applications. Somebody said, I have no idea if this is true. It sounds a little large to me, that the Mishnah contains 150,000 laws. Again, that sounds a little unbelievable to me, but somebody said this. But you have to understand that these are laws that are applications of principles. If you actually went through the whole Mishnah, if you knew the whole Mishnah, which is pretty hard to do, it wouldn't be 150,000 principles. The principles would be much fewer. Out of those principles, we derive many, 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 many laws. So the point that I'm making is, Hashem told Moshe the principles, it is the Chachamim that derive all of these different cases from those principles. And that is why there could be disagreement. You can have two people that have the same principles, but they will disagree how to apply those principles in given cases. Yeah.
I hear where you're coming from a very logical point of view, and I really understand. I have heard people say that, and I didn't hear their sources, why the when it's the Gemara is dictated to Moshe. But
yeah.
But the question I have is, if it's like, it's a very layered text seemingly still, the main example I would bring is like the tradition when it says Dama ben Nesina, the Goy from Ashkelon, and they have a whole story in each.
Yeah, was that given to Moshe?
No, but I'm saying each one of those details has significance. His name is Dama, like Dam, like.
Oh yes, so, like, so oh yes, for you, sure, for sure.
So why can you
Well, once again,
does that make it seem like it's a little more meaningful than just like something
said? I wasn't saying it's not meaningful. I mean, the Chachamim were people that had Ruach HaKodesh. They were people who were close to Hashem. They were people that had insight that is beyond our comprehension. All of that is, of course, true. All I'm saying was they didn't hear a voice where God put the word in. In other words, this was Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh is not the same as Nevuah. Nevuah is when Hashem speaks to you and gives you exact words. Ruach HaKodesh is a person is going about his business, but he's divinely inspired by the spirit of Hashem. So all the Chachamim, for sure, had Ruach HaKodesh. And as a result, even their choice of words is very, very significant. And that is why we are medayek in every word, every allusion, every detail. Of course, God forbid, I don't want anyone to walk away with a less of a sense of reverence for the words of Chazal. All I'm saying is, it was not a word-for-word transmission that came down to them. It was their own words. Now, their own words themselves are vested with infinite significance. It's certainly true for Rashi. Rashi was later. Rashi is after the Gemara, right? Rashi is hundreds of years after the Gemara. Rashi did not have some pre-existing Masorah to write things down, but Rashi's Ruach HaKodesh was able to fathom all these things. Yeah.
The fact that you said that there was vagueness when the Mishnah, or the principles were given over to Moshe, and that these small little details, like, say, what Binyamin was saying earlier, it sounds to me that it was to push, Hashem was trying to push that you need to have relationship with the physical, like, you also need to go into the world and understand what the world is. I'm not just going to give it all over to you.
That's right. Very good.
Because then you could just be like, you know, someone who just goes onto a mountain and just stays there because everything's already been given to them. Are there any explanations that say that this is a way of that was pushing our relationship with the physical?
Well, yes, in Hasidus that actually is a major point, that the whole idea of the Torah generally, which involves so many physical things, you know, you got to plant and harvest and all of these mitzvot, really compel a person to engage in the physicality of the world. One of the great theses of the Balatanya, he quotes a Medrash actually, but this is a phrase that more people know it from the Tanya than know it from the Medrash. And it says that Hashem wanted to make a Dira B'tachtonim. He wanted to make a dwelling place in the lowest of the worlds, the most physical of the worlds, the precisely where Hashem is the most hidden and the most concealed, is where Hashem wants His holiness to be brought out. And that is why the Torah is so physical, so to speak, in that way. It comes from the highest heaven, but it becomes the most physical of documents. It talks about how you plant and how you harvest, and in time of war, how you relieve yourself. There are laws in the Torah about all of those details, because it wants to bring godliness into every activity.
Was there a machlokas during Moshe's time, like for the Mishnah?
So here is the thing. The truth of the matter is, machlokas always existed, even in Moshe's time. But when there was a Sanhedrin, all machlokas was resolved, because the Torah basically says the Sanhedrin would vote, 71 members. So if it was 36 for and 36 against, halacha was 4. So the against no longer existed. So you have to know one thing. All the machloksim in the Mishnah, well, I don't want to say all, but 95% of the machloksim in the Mishnah date from after there was no longer a Sanhedrin. When there was no longer a Sanhedrin, there is no definitive way to resolve machlokas, and that's why machlokas survived. And then later we have people who paskin, etc. But there was no definitive resolution. Only when there's a Sanhedrin is there a real, absolute, definitive resolution. Even today. Now, again, these are complicated things. Let's say Rabbi Yashiv Zatzal was the posek of the door. Okay, so let's say Rabbi Yashiv paskined a certain way. And let's say I learned the sugya, and I disagreed. I thought Rebbe Yashiv was wrong. Now, if Rav Shlomo Zalman said like me, that's fine. But let's assume everybody said like Rebbe Yashiv. But I say, no. Now, here's the interesting question. Now, please don't misunderstand me. Do I have the right to paskin the way I think, even though Rebbe Yashiv said I was wrong? The answer is I do. Because if there's no Sanhedrin, there's no posek that binds me as long as I learn the sugya. Now, would it be wise for me to do it? Absolutely not. I would be a total idiot. In other words, here is the thing. Institutionally, every person can paskin the halacha based on how they understand it, unless there's a Sanhedrin. When there's a Sanhedrin, no matter how great you are, you have to accept their decision. When there's no Sanhedrin, then each person has the right. But look at it matters in terms of probabilities. What are the probabilities? Yeah, you have the right to make your own psak. What are the probabilities that you got it right and Rebbe Yashiv got it wrong? Well, I would say one in a trillion, or one in a quadrillion, or one in a quintillion. So, if you want to do the will of God, it makes sense that you follow the great people. But, theoretically, if you want to take your chances, I guess one in a trillion will happen one in a trillion times. So maybe after 120 years, maybe you got it right. Maybe you hit the spiritual jackpot, the spiritual lottery. In other words, I hope I'm making sense here. Meaning, you have to be mechalek between when there was a Sanhedrin and when there wasn't a Sanhedrin. When there was a Sanhedrin, and they paskened a halacha, you were absolutely not allowed to follow an alternative view. And even if your view is more correct, your view got erased by a decision of the Sanhedrin. So if you have all the proofs in the world, and even if God agrees with you, because that's what it means, the Torah is not in heaven, even if Hashem agrees with you, you have an Aveira, because the halacha becomes what the Sanhedrin says. When there's no Sanhedrin, That's not the situation. When there's no Sanhedrin, there is actually no definitive halacha on contested issues. And therefore, in theory, if I learned the sugya, I could be cholek on anybody. But it's a rule of probability. It is stupid and foolish to argue with people who are so much greater than me, because in probabilistic terms, they are almost certainly right and I am certainly wrong. You see the difference. In fact, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik writes that even in terms of the Gemara, it's fascinating, that why can't I argue on the Gemara? Now that may sound like kfira. He says, if the Gemara is after there was a Sanhedrin, in theory, now please hear out the whole sentence, in theory you could argue with the Gemara. But the probability is so infinitesimally small that you could possibly be correct that it makes no sense to do so. Now, that's a probabilistic argument of extreme... I don't mean like a, you know, one in two. I'm talking about a one in quadrillion, one in quintillion, one in whatever, septillion, whatever it would be. But Rav Chaim says it's ultimately a probability argument at an extremely high level. It is not a foreclosure argument, as would be the case vis-a-vis the Sanhedrin. Now, this is a controversial... I'm telling you something controversial. It is Rav Chaim said it. The Chazon Ish did not like it. The Chazon Ish was... He said, no, the Gemara is as like the Sanhedrin in that way. Rav Chaim said, well, no, Rav Chaim said it's not a Sanhedrin. In fact, even the rule that an Amora does not argue with the Tana is the same thing. Why can't an Amora argue with the Tana? Well, the Gemara always assumes an Amora will never argue with the Tana. Rav Chaim says, b'feirish, it was a probability argument. The Amorayim knew they were spiritually inferior to the Tanoim. So they knew it made no sense for them to argue. You see, in theory, they had the right to argue, but in practice, it was not sensible. I mean, to take a secular example, let's imagine you had Albert Einstein in the room. And let's assume that you imagined that Einstein didn't really understand the theory of relativity that well. And you want to correct Einstein on his on the understanding of relativity. Now, do you have the right to do that? Yeah. I mean, Einstein is not God. I mean, could Einstein be wrong? Yeah. But would it be logical for you to basically say you understand relativity better than Einstein? I wouldn't think so. Maybe. I see now that sometimes they have these prodigies. But, you know, the press likes to exaggerate. 14-year-old is going to disprove, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity. Whatever it is. Well, you know, I kind of doubt it, but, you know, who knows? And the like. Right? So these are subtle ideas, and these can be misunderstood, and they're not what you normally hear in yeshiva. I appreciate that. But, so don't report on me. But it is important to understand that Torah Shebaal Peh is very dynamic in that way, but it does emanate with what Hashem told Moshe. So their vadai is the basic principles were given to Moshe, they were handed down from generation to generation, but it gets expanded and augmented with all sorts of interpretations and debates and machloksim and the like. Yeah.
So who agrees with the stuff that you just told us, like Rambam, Rashi, Rambam?
Well, this is, I'm basically describing what the Rambam says.
Rambam.
Maimonides, yeah, Maimonides, and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik much later. Rabbi Chaim Wasserman. In fact, the truth of the matter, the Ran was one of the great Rishonim.
Rashi and other people hold otherwise.
In other words, sometimes they don't address it in these terms, but you don't have a contradiction. I don't think this is contradicted by anything. Some address it, some don't address it, but I don't think it's a contradiction. Yet.
This is slightly different because it's hashkafic, but if it were to have a halachic ramification, it would be a problem. So basically, I was having a discussion with someone recently. He said that Rav Dessler said that psychology was problematic because it's based on tests where they see what people sometimes do, and then that means that psychology doesn't believe people have free will. So of course, that might be the psychology of 60 or 70 years ago, but it's nothing to do with what psychology is now.
Yeah.
So let's say that someone were to take that information to a posek and say, should I see a psychologist or not? Or should I study psychology? Whatever they're looking to do. And the person says, based on this Rav Dessler, I think you shouldn't. I'm posing that you shouldn't. And it's a very big person. So you couldn't argue with them because... But in the Lemaise, it was based on incorrect information or non-current information. So when we're bringing that... I'm trying to understand that probability... Does that change when the information is changed?
Yeah, it absolutely does change. And in fact, in a sense, what I might tell you is that you have posed a fake question, meaning the following. A great Talmud Chacham will take into account... Now, you're telling me, oh, a great Talmud Chacham, based on Rav Dessler, said you shouldn't see a psychologist.
Yeah.
But my answer to you is, a great Talmud Chacham is not going to give a psak like that, right, because a great Talmud Chacham will understand that there may be other factors to consider. It's only a lesser person will kind of be frozen into what was said 70 years ago. Now, right, you see what I'm saying? So, in a sense, your question is almost an imaginary question. Although, unfortunately, it's not so.
No, I'm saying that there could be.
Absolutely.
There could be people now who aren't aware of all
absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And all I can tell you is that when Rav Moshe was asked different shilas, which depended on certain knowledge, when Rav Yosef was asked shilas, when Rav Shlomo Zalman, they would often say that they are not familiar enough with the factual situation to be able to give a psak. See, in psak halacha, there is a phenomenon, irreverently, you could call garbage in, garbage out, meaning like this. A psak halacha might be a perfect psak halacha, but it's based on factual mistake, based on what was presented to the rabbi. If the rabbi is told X, Y, and Z, he'll paskin on X, Y, and Z, but the reality might not be X, Y, and Z. The reality might be A, B, C. So is the psak false? No, the psak is not false. The psak is true on the facts that were given. But the facts that were given happen not to be true. Now, a gadol does not have time to personally investigate every scenario in the world. If a gadol would have to investigate psychology and medicine and technology and engineering, he would have no time to learn. He wouldn't be a gadol. So a gadol, by definition, has to rely on the story that he's told, on the facts that he's told, on the people that he consults. They are not always gadol. they could, you know, intentionally sometimes, most of the time, you know, mistakenly, could distort things. The gadol is not an achrai because the gadol has to rely. This is a complicated, this is a very, very complicated question. I will tell you about your specific thing, that really around the time Rav Dessler said it, and even before, all of you have heard of Rav Shlomo Volba. In fact, you learn, I know the Mussar group learns Alei Shur. Beautiful, beautiful, magnificent sefer. I hope that this group also has a chance to learn Alei Shur. I don't know if you have another Mussar shur or whatever it is. But Rav Volba was a young man during World War II, and he spent the time in Switzerland. He managed to get out of Germany to go to Switzerland, which was neutral. Switzerland, whatever it is. Jews were able to live, and for whatever it is. I don't know why everybody respects Swiss neutrality. Hitler was conquering all of Europe, but Switzerland you leave alone. I don't know exactly why that's so sacrosanct. Nobody ever touches Switzerland. But be it as may, he was in Switzerland during World War II. And he spent time, since there were no yeshivas there, he spent time with Jean Piaget. Now, I don't know if you've heard of Jean Piaget. Jean Piaget is a guy, was a guy, and he was considered to be the greatest child psychologist of the 20th century. He really did pioneering, fundamental work in how children learn to think and how children develop a sense of morality and consciousness. And since Rav Volba was a Baal Musar, who wanted to understand midos and how you develop midos, he went to this great child psychologist to kind of see what insights he could take from the moral development of children and apply them to personality development generally. Now, you might say, oh, he's going to Goyim, he's going to psychology, but he felt that that was nichlal in the idea of Chachma Bagayim Tamim, that there is valid wisdom even among the Gentiles. So he felt that you could. Now, in fact, even the point that psychology denies free will, well, as you say, number one, that's been changed. But even though we believe in free will, we also believe that a person's drives can make it very, very difficult to overcome, right? So there's still something valuable in seeing what are my drives, what are my pulls, what are my yetzer haras, what are the things I have to fight against. And psychology can help you in identifying that, right? So I'm not giving you a psak to go to a therapist, not go to a therapist. But all I can say is that contemporaneously with Rav Dessler, there were those who felt that psychology would be useful. In fact, there's even a mesora among Chabad, they don't like to talk about it too much, but they talk about it a little bit, that the fifth Chabad Rebbe, who was the Rebbe Rashab, he's called Rashab is Rav Shalom Bear, actually went to Sigmund Freud. He had some treatment with Sigmund Freud in Vienna, dealing with depression and the like. Very, very fascinating. What did Freud tell him? That was interesting, at least what they say. Freud told him, you need to have your Hasidim tell you when good things happen. Because when people go to a Rebbe, they tell them all of their problems, all of their tzaras. When Baruch Hashem, things turn out to be good, you know, they never tell the Rebbe. He says, you need to tell your Hasidim to come back with good news. And then you'll get some chizah from the hadracha that you give them. That's a good advice for even guys here. Okay, have a good day.